Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, welcome to the 264th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Vicky Goggin and Noah Alexander. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Yoko Okumura on the podcast, and this is a very fun talk. And I want to send a shout out to Kevin Berlandi, who introduced us to Yoko. Yoko is a director that has done a ton of things. She's done music videos and documentaries. And most recently, she has gone deep into the world of TV. She did this awesome horror anthology series called 50 States of Fright. She just directed an episode of Good Trouble. And she actually made this TikTok video that went kind of viral about how she went from working at a sushi restaurant to directing an episode of TV to working at a sushi restaurant to directing an episode of TV, all in the course of a few months. And I just love that. I thought it was so inspiring. It's about how success isn't linear. And it's something that, you know, as artists, as creatives, as freelancers, as filmmakers, we need to remember, because it is easy to get into that rut of like, well, I already did this project and it had this success. So my
with
next,
my resume,
yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah. My next project has to be bigger, and it does not have to be bigger. In fact, a lot of times when you do the big one and then a small one and a big one and a small one, those small ones teach you more about yourself as a filmmaker than the big ones.
And to that end, I think Yoko has done a really great job of keeping herself creative and inspired and engaged. And we dig in deep about her history of making short films and self-starting in that way, in addition to all of the other, you know, kind of bigger paying jobs that she's done over the years. So it's a really inspiring, exciting conversation. She's got a great point of view. We talk a lot about also her kind of how she honed in on her own artistic voice and her time at AFI and how that kind of helped serve her. So if you're curious about film school and whether that's interesting or not to you, I think that's another big thing that we touch on.
Yeah, I think one of these patterns we see a lot is we see these filmmakers that seem kind of young and new, and you're like, they just made it so fast. How did they do it so fast? And then you talk to them and you're like, this person has done every program, went to film school undergrad, went to grad school. And it's, you know, Yoko is like this perfect example of a person that has just like hustled and worked so hard and like honed her craft and created so many things that it just reminds me, at least, about the perseverance that's required to be a working director in this business. And so it's awesome and it's inspiring, and I think you'll enjoy our talk with her. But before we talk to Yoko, I had a question for you, Matt. What have you been thinking about lately?
What have I been thinking about? Because I haven't been working. I've just been kind of...
No, but because I'm setting you up, because I know you had a slight epiphany.
A thing that this podcast and career in Hollywood, if there's one thing that they both have in common, it's that you constantly are relearning the same lessons over and over again, or just being reminded that, you know, certain things hold true throughout a career.
Yeah. Rainy tiny.
Sure. Lefty loosey. So regular listeners will remember that I've kind of been in the early stages of taking a new project out. It's a feature and I haven't done a ton of work in that space. And so I'm kind of looking to kind of create some new introductions and things like that. And I was reminded that basically the rule is, or the lesson that I've had, the epiphany that I've had, is that it's so much easier to ask a specific question It's much so much more effective to ask a specific question than a general question, regardless of how badly the person you're speaking with wants to help you, right? So for instance, you know, if you're looking for anyone who maybe would be interested in working on this movie, which feels like a totally good and valid question, and maybe is, it just requires that people sort of comb their mental Rolodex of literally every single person they know who might possibly like the crazy movie that you're trying to make, right? And you don't want to ask a close-ended question, right? That's the mentality. You want to be able to keep things open. And, you know, for them, if you say, oh, I'm looking for a producer, and they're thinking of an actor who they, you know, could produce, but is really, you know, whatever, you don't want to close things off. But it takes a lot of mental energy and bandwidth for people to come up with answers to that open of a question. Whereas if you're like, hey, I noticed this person, or I've been looking to meet this person or that person, or even this type or someone at this company, it's a heck of a lot easier for them to be like, yes or no, I know this person.
Yeah. I mean, or even if you go on Facebook and you say, hey, I noticed that you know this actor, know this development exec, or know this, do you think you can introduce me to them? Is so much easier than, what do you think I should do with my movie? Or do you know any producers you can send this to? It's the, I think the most common example that we've talked about many times is the like, hey, I'd love to take you out for coffee and pick your brain. And then you go to coffee with this person that's there to pick your brain. And you're like, yeah, pick my brain. What do you want? And they're like, well, what do you think I should do? And I'm like, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
Do that?
Yeah. And that's not to say, I get it. I get why people... I've done that. You've done that. Yeah.
No, I learned the hard way that general questions will get you general answers. And that whenever you're asking for help, your number one objective should be to make it as easy as possible for the person you're asking for help from to give you that help.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
My kind of common example is like, let's say you made a web series, or you made a short film, or you made a movie, and you want someone at BuzzFeed to write an article about it, or Jezebel or whatever. You email them about it. You say like, hey, you know, I know you've written about this topic before. I made this short about it. I thought you could pitch it as this and this and this. And even when people pitch guests to our podcast, they say, oh, we thought, you know, so-and-so can come on your podcast and talk about how she did this or how she did that. And I think you and I are instantly more receptive to that because we don't have to figure out what to talk about. Like someone is giving us an entry point. So I know that's a little more macro than what you're saying, but the idea of asking for something and being very specific, like 99 times out of 100, you'll get better results than asking for something very generic. Like, hey, you should have me on your podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's also a thing where the older we get, the busier our peers are. Right. Like their people are getting promoted. They're making other things. So, you know, if it's a question that they can answer on their way from the elevator to their office, you know, on their phone, you're going to get an answer. If it's like, I kind of need to sit down and Google or maybe do some thinking or whatever, it just kind of sinks down the stack. So I think that's the other thing to think about is, you know, who is answering and what sort of answer are you hoping for? If it's literally a yes or no, it's a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah. I remember when I first moved to LA, I was doing a lot of camera stuff. And people would always email me like, hey, what camera should I get, Oren? And I would be like, okay, well, I'm not going to answer that email right now because I need to spend 2 hours researching, you know, this. And I'd write them a long email about the pros and cons of the different models and how much they want to spend and what they want to use it for. And then they'd like never respond to me and it would make me furious.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also important to note that like the circumstances specifically where this technique has been helpful, in every circumstance, all of the people I'm talking to, they're genuine, they're friends I've known for years. So they all actually want to help me. So I want to just make sure that it's clear, in the same way that you really wanted to help the person who didn't want to read this giant email about cameras and stuff, you know, there's nothing personal about any of it. It's just like fine tuning how to get an answer that's helpful. So like if someone was just like, hey, Oren, I was thinking of buying the 5D, yes or no. you probably would have just been like, you know, the 60D.
I would never have said that.
I know you never would have said that.
No, I'm kidding. But yeah, so I think that's a good lesson. I think it's something that even I, you know, when a lot of people get reps, you know, we have that issue where like, great, I have a manager, I have an agent. Now, what do I do with this person? And they're really only as useful as you can figure out specifically what to ask them for. I mean, it depends.
I think there's a little bit more. They are in the business of collaborating with you, but also I think there's a big difference between the first 3 months of working with someone and, you know, 3 years down the line in terms of game plans and strategy and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess that was a bad example.
No, I think it's a great example, but I think that things shift, right? You know, and again, it's like managing people's times and expectations. The thing that actually maybe is pertinent also is like, I feel like agents, it's a power move to write fewer words. Like the fewer words that an agent writes, the more powerful they feel. And so that's not a blanket rule, but I know that there are genuinely plenty of them that do feel that way. And it drives me insane.
I feel like it's just an efficient, people that are efficient communicators write short emails.
Yeah, there's a difference between short emails and so short that they feel flippant.
Where you're like, hey, did we get the details of the detail of the deal yet? And they write back, yes.
Yeah, you're like, all right, I need a little bit more. Like, yes, we'll follow up once we have them finished.
Exactly.
That would be fine.
Speaking of finished, we're done with this intro. Let's tell people about our Patreon page.
That's right, patreon.com/justshootapod.
Yeah, if you go to patreon.com/justshootapod right now, you can support this podcast, the podcast that we literally get dozens of emails about a week telling us how much this podcast has helped you. You can give us a few bucks to help it go. I know that maybe sometimes being a Patreon, you don't know how much we appreciate you, but I want to tell people, to tell our patrons from Patreon that we it really does mean a lot to us. It really does make a huge difference in keeping this podcast going. Matt and I
would say it's safe to say that if we didn't have the Patreon, the show wouldn't still be on the air.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we literally, I think maybe 3 years into the show, we're like, oh, should we do seasons? And then we just kind of gave up on that idea because we literally put out an episode, a new episode every single week. We don't even do any of that like best of episode crap that every other podcast does. So yeah, the Patreon is the thing that keeps us going, that keeps us motivated, keeps us booking new guests and excited to talk to all of you and meet the listeners. So check it out, patreon.com/justshootapod.
It makes the show possible because we continue to realize that we need different resources and bigger and better help. You know, Sarah, shout out to Sarah, our editor, who has taken on more responsibilities. We brought on a social media manager, all sorts of stuff that is helping the show grow. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah. And if you give us 10 bucks, even once, you'll get a Just Shoot It hat, which is very cool. And anyone that posts a story with a Just Shoot It hat, as is evidenced by Just Shoot It listener Emilio, we will repost that photo
we
on our story.
Reposting. Yeah.
We love reposting your photos, so just do it. It's fun. It's like we become friends by you wearing that hat. Anyway, very long plug for our Patreon. I apologize. Patreon.com/justshootapod. Check it out. We love you guys. And now we're gonna talk to Yoko Okumura. Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's just shoot it 50 off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium, or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the US, that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the US. That's JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF.
Check him out. Let us know how it goes. Yeah, congrats on your gig you just did in Canada.
Thank you. I just got back and I'm very happy to be back in the warm weather of Los Angeles.
Remind us, what were you doing in Canada?
I was directing my first block of television, which is two episodes, on a freeform show called The Bold Type.
Oh, cool. I love typography.
Yeah, like, right?
Did you do a serifed episode or a sans serif episode? I know they kind of go back and forth.
Bold is the only part that I know of. I cannot make a font joke if my life depended on it, so I'm sorry.
I pulled the best one I had, so, you know.
Yeah, just... Shut the Helvetica up, okay, man.
Oof. Yikes.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, dad jokes. Look out. Yeah.
Arnie cursing. Anyway, so yeah, Bold Type, Freeform. That's cool. And you had done TV before though, right? 50 States of Fright? Isn't that not TV?
I guess technically DGA world, it was new media.
It's in the premium digital world.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. 50 States of Fright was a Quibi show that I did, like, you know, an installment of an anthology of. So that was my first like DGA gig, but it was not television, quote unquote. My first like 1 hour drama television show was called Good Trouble, which is also a freeform show. And that I shot in November, and it just came out like a few weeks ago.
Oh, my wife was pinned twice for that show, and then she didn't get the part, so.
Really? Oh, dang. Could Bummer,
be,
yeah.
Could be your fault.
Could be my fault. Probably. I'm curious what character she was going for.
Do you shoot that after 50 States of Fright, right?
Yes, 50 States of Fright was September and October 2019, I believe. And Good Trouble was November 2020. So there was a whole year that passed in between those two projects.
Well, maybe let's rewind, because I think you have kind of a recent history. Let's kind of talk about where you learned to be a filmmaker. Did you go to film school?
Yes, I've gone to what I call an embarrassing amount of film school, an abundance of film school. Yeah, and it even started in high school. Like, even in high school, I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We had a arts high school that was government funded. So I went to a media arts program for the last 2 years of high school. So I was learning DV, you know, DV camera filmmaking and Final Cut and all that jazz. And from there, went to Cal Arts. And that was, you know, back in the early 2000s. And yeah, I've been in LA ever since. But it's been a rocky, long road. Like, I've done so many different kinds of positions, like, before I really committed to being a director. It's been like years of, you know, I was a camera assistant, I was producing documentaries, I was, you know, an extra. Like, I really have done everything.
Well,
let's talk about the extra work. So how do you do that?
Yeah. Do you say peas and carrots or watermelon? What's your method there? No. Let's talk about AFI, actually, because I don't think that we've had a ton of AFI students or any other kind of like art school oriented guests, actually. And I think that's worth talking about. I come from a more like, quote unquote, Hollywood style of film schools. Like, USC is like Hollywood University, right? So it's very narrative oriented, you know, right. Like,
it's like how to make Forrest Gump.
Yeah, exactly. Genuinely, right? Like, you go to USC because, you know, George Lucas went there, and, you know, you see Steven Spielberg wearing a USC hat. AFI, you know, plenty of very famous alums, but is real artsy fartsy. You know,
I meant Cal Arts.
Yeah. And then AFI is much more craft oriented. We'll get to that in a second. But so undergrad, you know, like, you know, famously Tim Burton came out of Cal Arts, right? Like, all of the like major Disney and Pixar people came out of Cal Arts.
Some of the best like, animators, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely the Harvard of animation.
Yeah,
I did not go for animation. I went to the film video department undergrad, so very different.
Follow-up question then, were you making narrative film, or were you doing more experimental work, or like, tell us about that sort of environment and the way that artsy fartsiness bleeds over into your brain?
Yes, it was absolutely artsy fartsy. That is the correct term for the school. It was absolutely not narrative based. And, you know, I spent the first few years making experimental films for sure. All the classes are taught by like gallery artists who was like height was in the 70s and, you know, partying and doing drugs and making, you know, gallery art with video. And so that was kind of my foundation, and I was enjoying that at the time. And then I kind of like was also like dabbling in documentary and experimenting in that form. But then eventually there was something in me that knew I wanted to do more narrative work, and that's what I was drawn to. So I actually started to take like I would ask graduate level class like teachers and instructors like if I could take those classes. So because CalArts MFA
is... Like, sorry, you're only paying $120,000 a year. That's like the $250,000 a year program.
Yeah, exactly. Stay away. No, they were down for me to join. You know, you take the initiative and you can kind of do whatever you want to at that school. So I took grad classes that was much more about scene work and narrative work. And it was still artsy fartsy, though, you know, the scenes we were doing and stuff. But
Sure. It's all relative, right? But yeah, so that's interesting. So when did you realize, I want to be doing kind of more traditional work? And was that in rebellion to the sort of the more abstract stuff that you were doing? Is that kind of what drew it out of you? Like, where did that realization come from?
I don't think I ever had like an aha moment that I could describe to you. It really was an evolution of just like my interests. And I think I just did start to genuinely get bored of work that was so esoteric and that work that really needed like a descriptor in order to actually understand it. And I kept, even in experimental work, I was much more, you know, emotion and story based anyway. And I wanted to feel something, right? And a lot of times this, you know, gallery artwork, even if it was beautiful, even if it was like intellectually stimulating, you know, it was lacking the humanity for me. So I just naturally gravitated towards wanting to learn about, you know, working with actors and telling stories.
And is that what inspired you to go to AFI thereafter?
Yeah. So, you know, after graduating CalArts, you know, I worked at Sugarfish, Like, that was my life, is being
which
a hostess.
Which is a fancy sushi restaurant.
Yes,
with
correct.
With a genuine cult following, right? Like, people love Sugarfish.
Yeah.
I used to be in that cult.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Are you no longer?
He's a Nobu guy now. That's what happened.
Even fancier.
Sugarfish, so to our listeners that haven't been there, like, the allure for me as a fairly clueless person is that you go in, there's like basically three things you can order. The Trust Me Light, or Nozawa Special, whatever. I always got the Trust Me, so I don't know what the other ones were. But then you tell the server, you know, if there's anything you don't eat in particular, and then they just bring you, at the time, the first time you go there, it feels like they bring you whatever is on their mind, you know? Like, what's the fresh fish? Oh, Chef Nozawa went to the market and his brother or whatever sent him this fish from Japan this morning. The mackerel is amazing or whatever. And it just felt like this custom, bespoke, like, experience. And the fish was so good. It was like biting into, like, butter, you know, and it was like real, and they'd be like, don't put sauce on it, don't put soy sauce, and it's like this magical experience. But then, you know, the 50th time you go there and it's that exact same thing, and they're kind of giving you the same things you got the first time, and you're like, okay, I will put the soy sauce on whatever damn fish I please.
The illusion was broken for you.
Yeah. And then once you get it for takeout, it's like totally like you lose that whole experience, which is what I've done, you know.
Listen,
during COVID. So
Yoko realized that she loves telling stories, and this was actually a perfect opportunity to weave the tapestry of a bespoke sushi experience.
So after CalArts, you know, I was doing second ACing, but that wasn't making enough money. So then I got, you know, work at Sugarfish, and through all of that, somehow I made a short called The Darlings. I made documentary shorts.
Tell us about The Darlings real quick. Give us the log line, just kind of like, just to set up what sort of work you were interested in at the time.
Yeah, The Darlings was very abstract and very CalArtsy, actually. It was about two girls who, you know, talk about killing a boyfriend, but in a very abstract way, where you have no idea what they're talking about pretty much the whole time.
At least they're speaking dialogue. You know what I mean?
There was dialogue. Even that early on, you know, I was in my early 20s. Like, I could see my stamp of, like, liking very colorful and, like, you know, curated wardrobe and, you know, production design aesthetic. So that was already there. And, yeah, I think the greatest thing that came out of CalArts really was, like, the friendships, right? Like, so I was surrounded by filmmakers who were all, you know, all struggling together and making films together. And, my roommates at the time were also filmmakers, so I had that resource of a group that I could make films with. So yeah, with, like, I think $500 or something, we made a short called The Darlings, and that I used to submit to AFI. I had another short that I made right after CalArts that was very narrative, just so I could challenge myself to make a narrative film. It was silly, it was cute. It was about a little girl who, like, sneaks into her neighbor's house to, like, steal back the unknown, like a gnome like figurine that was like the Minnesota Vikings. It was very silly, but that cost like $500 too, and I just was practicing shorts for a pretty long time.
And do you feel like these shorts were like helping your career in any way, or was it more like practice as a filmmaker?
I mean, at
like,
that
did
time
did you do festivals and all that stuff?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure I submitted, but I didn't get into any festivals. Like, I absolutely did not get into any festivals, but I kept making them, man. I'm addicted to shorts. I can't stop.
So was there an intention, though? Like, were you like, we'll make this, we'll try to get into festivals, we'll like, or we'll adapt this into a feature? Or was it more like, I have an idea, wouldn't it be funny if two women are talking about something and then we realize it's about killing their boyfriend?
Yeah, I mean, that one I definitely think we made with the intention of, so I co-directed that and then co-wrote it as well. And at that point, we were hoping that it could get into festivals and hoping that it could, you know, do something for our careers. But ultimately, it wasn't helpful in that regards of like exposure and getting into festivals. But for me, it was very helpful of being a work sample to get into AFI.
In terms of timeline, I feel like now we have Film Freeway. But before that, you kind of just had to like, you know, find a list of good film festivals and then like Google them, right? Like now it's a la carte. You can just like, you know, you put in your credit card and you go boop, 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 and they're, you know, it's submitted everywhere, right?
Yeah, but so, The Darlings is 2013. So
2013, yeah, yes, so you could have done without a box.
It's height.
2013, it's fun. Again, IMDb, you know, it's not as accurate as you might think it is, because we made it in 2011, 2012, and then I guess took a while to, you know, put it on IMDb.
Yes, but I guess my point being, like, I think there's the mentality of like, oh yeah, we'll make a short and like we'll submit it to South By and Sundance and Tribeca and a handful of places, and, you know, maybe my friends work at Nashville or Austin or something like that, we should send it there too. But for the most part, you don't, you know, submit a ton of places when you're young and maybe you don't know quite as many festivals, right? But there are those tools specifically from Film Freeway now where you can kind of expand your horizons a little bit more. And I think also when you're young and broke, when you spend $500 on your short, and that's a lot of friggin' money, $50 a pop on these festivals is pretty rough too, you know?
Yeah, it's a ton of money, and somehow you just kind of scrape by and do it.
That's almost half a Trust Me at Sugarfish.
I know. Oh my gosh. No, I could not afford Sugarfish when I worked at Sugarfish. So
yeah, no doubt.
I felt that pain. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think out of CalArts, again, my group of friends were doing pretty well. I mean, a lot of them are doing well still. But yeah, I think we had, my friend had gotten into Sundance like right out of CalArts. And so we all kind of went and stuff. And so we were pretty familiar with film festivals. But yeah, it was still kind of the early Without a Box world. And that website was no bueno. that was a terrible interface. And yeah, but yeah, we were familiar with them to at least know like where to, you know, put our money and lose it.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
And at that time, were you focused on directing? Like, that's like the end goal, is like you want to direct stuff, right? Because you said you're also doing some technical stuff, and obviously you're doing some writing and like the camera stuff.
Yeah, while you're crewing, you're still like, oh, I am the prize. Directing is the thing.
Kind of, you know, I mean, deep down, yes, the desire was to direct and to write and to make my own films. But honestly, like, there was so much self-consciousness and feeling like a loser after film school and like working at a sushi restaurant and being like, how dare I even dream? And how could I even say I want to be a director? Like, everybody wants to be a director. So there was a lot of like feeling not good enough that made it so I probably couldn't even vocalize that at that age, looking back now.
And do you feel like that was part of the reason why you kept making shorts and, you know, like, was it like a thing of taking baby steps? Oh, maybe grad school will help with that. Or like, what helped you get over that eventually?
Yeah, I think AFI was the big step that made me finally feel like, okay, I can own the identity of director and I can own the desire to succeed as a director. Once I got into AFI, that was definitely the catalyst.
And so you went to AFI on the directing track, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had originally like actually intended of applying as a producer and even like toured it as like interested in a producer. But I think somehow along the way, I realized kind of the self-conscious kind of BS I was, you know, telling myself of like, oh, you should do a producer, like, which is kind of the secondary thing I wanted to do. So I think I owned up to my actual desire and was like, fuck it, I'll, you know, apply to be a director.
That's cool. And so how was AFI? Like, I'm seeing your next... I apologize for reading about you on IMDb.
Yeah, you better be. Very sorry.
But I see that your next short after The Darlings was Last Meal. Was that an AFI short?
That was an AFI short. And in between The Darlings and Last Meal was like one, two, three other AFI shorts that never even go onto IMDb because they're considered like your cycle films or like very much practice films. So I made like full three short films that first year I was a directing fellow. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing like practicing, you know, having a dedicated time to practice like that and be able to make mistakes and try different genres, try different techniques. And AFI to me in that way was so incredible because, yeah, I got to try things that I never could have afforded on my own if I had not, you know, taken out the student loans and done
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And well, and also, like, I think the deadlines and then also the community are the other things. It sounds like you weren't lacking in community, like, with your CalArts friends. But I think for people at home listening, like, oh, maybe film school's for me, those are the other things that tend to kind of...
Yes.
You know,
yeah, the cycle films at AFI, when I went there, was about, like, I think $3,000 or $4,000 each film was, like, the budget you had to work within. And obviously the school, as a part of your tuition, is that they provide that budget. And that is not an amount of money I could have, you know, accessed to make my own short films.
Oh, so that's interesting. So they give you that money cash and that's what you're putting towards like wardrobe and props and stuff like that, or
you know, I actually don't know how that worked, if they got a debit card or got actual cash from the school, because I was not in producing. I let the producers take care of it. I have no idea.
But the producers, gotcha.
But that's fine. That's kind of cool. What we were able to do for, like hiring some people that we needed, getting wardrobe and getting, you know, feeding people. That was all stuff that they had to budget for. But like the crew was a lot, mostly our fellow students. So they were free.
Or maybe Oren.
Yeah, I did.
I honestly like learned a lot at AFI. I had a friend that went there. She was a producer, and I worked on like all her shorts and then all her friends' shorts, and I was just working on everything. And
Lauren was like the weird guy who was crewing for free, and you never saw in classes.
Yeah. Then, we had a lot of those.
Sure.
At lunch, like during an AFI shoot, like all the students would sit together, and I would just be like, sitting with like the the catering guy.
That's funny. Oh, you should have joined them. We don't bite. I'm sure you would have been welcome.
My friend who hired me pretended not to know me. It was rough. No, I actually applied to AFI while I was working on an AFI short, and I got the rejection while I was like dolly gripping.
You were gripping. Oh no. Yeah.
And they're like, Oren, get off the phone. Dolly needs to go over here. Carry this up 4 flights of stairs. By yourself. That's
such a scene in a movie.
It was. But so what did you learn at AFI? I'm curious.
Oh my gosh, like everything. You know, I think before I went to AFI, I didn't even know what I had to learn. Like I didn't even know that what I didn't know. You know?
Like what are some things? Because obviously you'd gone to film school, you'd made shorts, you'd worked on sets, you worked on Shutter Island, apparently, according to IMDb, which lies about everything.
That one's true.
And so you had an idea of like the things that it takes to make a movie, at least on a practical, logistical level. But what did you learn at AFI that you didn't even know that you didn't know?
Definitely like that there's an actual like craft of directing, like tool sets that you can learn that you can continuously like fall back on in order to tell an emotionally evocative story for the audience.
Like what's an example of that? Like a over the shoulder shot?
Yeah, exactly. Just mediums, close-ups, and extreme close-ups.
Or in your quote-unquote busting balls here, but that sort of stuff.
No, I'm not busting. I'm
genuinely some of that stuff. Yeah. You and I don't want to by in any way like put down art schools, but they are not focused on some things that we take for granted. Do you know what I mean?
Like and the line of action or whatever, like kind of just like film making 101
Or maybe they
things.
Do a little bit of it, but then they're kind of moving into like, this is what happens when you put, you know, your film in the oven, you know, your assignment is everybody has to figure out a different experimental technique that's going to make unique images. And like, that's super interesting. And you could, you know, all sorts of different ways you could apply it, but that's not the same as like what Ron Howard teaches in his masterclass. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so, but what was your, like, what are kind of the big takeaways from AFI that you maybe weren't learning on your own, you know?
I think the C word there is collaboration. And they really hone in on how incredibly important that is. And then we are building together like a specific vocabulary to lean on. Because again, you know, we have a lot of film schools, you are kind of hopping different roles, right? You might be an editor one day, a director one day, a producer one day. At AFI, we're all dedicated in our tracks from the very beginning. So you really learn how you need to collaborate and communicate with people to the degree you'll have to when you're a professional outside of school. I mean, one of the first assignments that we had to do at first year was a director was like matched with a cinematographer, right? And then they would, the teacher would give you like a prompt, like, this is a scene about a woman who just lost her child. And you had to go run off like on campus or off campus and like do a story within a frame. So you had to like figure out together how to tell a story with just one frame and go like
without moving the camera.
Without moving the camera, just one still image and like how to evoke that emotion and how to tell it by where the camera is, how to tell it by the physicality of the characters in it. So stuff like that, you know, like things that again, like
that's
CalArts was not
going
to teach me that.
Yeah, for sure.
That is very cool.
That's awesome. A really, really cool exercise for sure.
Yeah. And so the subjectivity of the camera and how you use it in order to communicate, you know, in order to get an emotional reaction out of an audience, like that was a huge part of what I personally learned, is like the POV of the emotional POV of a narrative and what that really, really means.
That's like AFI's favorite thing, right? Is like the POV, right? Like whose point whose shot is this? Well, so when I was working on those shorts, and I was joking about being so disconnected, but I was also making, you know, my own short films and YouTube videos and things. And I remember if we, you know, I would hire or bring on like a cinematographer, and I'd bring on like a some sort of art person, and we'd be like, oh yeah, this room needs to look like a doctor's office, and let's, you know, whatever, shoot this in the easiest way possible.
I've got a skeleton and some tissue paper for your bed or something.
Yeah. And that's how I kind of thought of filmmaking. And then I would see the students at AFI, and I'd see the production designer has like schematics of like the set and diagrams and elevations and like a mood board. And then I saw the DP would have like a PDF file or a deck that they had printed out of images, reference images and research and inspiration. And I was like, oh, this is like what people that are serious about this do. And that's something I was never really a part of it, but I witnessed it at AFI. I witnessed like the DP and the director looking at visual references. And I was like, wow, that seems cool. And it's something that it's so obvious once you've done it, but when you're just a bunch of kids making videos together, it might not occur to you to kind of be intentional in that way.
If your question is like I wrote a funny video about a doctor's office, the obvious thought is like, well, how can we shoot in a doctor's office or make my bedroom look like one? Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But
that's really
AFI,
great.
AFI, there was a lot, and I'm sure most film schools, there's a lot more thought, like what color, what kind of wallpaper would this doctor have? And what does this tell about him? And what's on the shelves, and where is the camera and all that stuff? So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that sort, and that the process of figuring that out is very much was integrated into like the prep process, and it was expected of us. And, you know, the DPs have to do these crazy books, like these huge books, like that break down and analyze every single scene that they do and the choices they made, the lenses they use and why, and like the narrative perspective and like the emotional like point of view, and like books, like huge books that look like dictionaries they have to submit and like get reviewed by their faculty. And like those books are a big part of whether they get invited back or not. And so, yeah, a huge amount goes into educating us on that.
When you say get invited back, is it not guaranteed that you complete the program?
It is not guaranteed.
Weren't like Aronofsky and David Lynch like famously not invited back or something?
Yeah. So back in the day, it really was very cutthroat in that sense of like half the class could get cut and like nobody comes back. But now it's more like maybe one or two people might not be invited back per track. And yeah, I think my directing class had one person who wasn't invited back. I think the DP track had two people. It's less aggressive as it used to be, I think, but it still happens.
Boy, that really sucks much more for the people who don't get invited back. Like when half the class gets invited back, it's a little easier to live with yourself.
Right.
When you're like, oh man, I'm the only person.
Yeah.
That's rough. Though I will say I didn't get into production at USC. I got into critical studies, which is like the nerdy theory part. And I know a lot of people... I think those early rejections, I think, are genuinely super important and valuable for your durability as a filmmaker into the future, basically. Like if you suck it up as a teenager or in your early 20s, you can go the distance, you know?
Yeah, I think famously, like the most famous alumni at AFI didn't do their second years, right? Like Aronofsky and stuff. Like the people they claim as their most, you know, valuable alumni didn't get invited back, and they just, you know, use that to fuel them to actually succeed.
Yeah, right. And sometimes it's not about you as a filmmaker as much as you as a student, probably.
Yes.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Okay, so you went to AFI, you made a thesis film, and that got you... CAA reps and TV deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So put like 5-7 years in between that, but correct. Kind of. Yeah. I made a thesis film. So our second year is completely dedicated to the thesis film, and you're teaming up with people and getting married to them as a team for the year. And, that film, so that's how I met Kevin. That film called Kimi Kabuki was my short film. It was about a housewife that follows her husband to a porn convention and then learns about intimacy from an unexpected source. That was so fun to make.
And you wrote it too.
I wrote it too. Yeah. wrote and directed that.
So how did you come up with it?
I came up with that short idea. AFI was also a big part of teaching me, like, the best stories for you to tell are the ones that, you know, you have some emotional pain behind that's very authentic to you. And I always knew that, like, you know, pornography was something, and coming up as a teenager, as a young girl, like in the early aughts, was something that was never contextualized to me properly. And so, like, it's just something that you get exposed to as a teenage girl, like, because your boyfriend is watching it and you, like, catch him, right? And then you just have no idea what to do with that information. And you just, and for me, it was like I felt compared to it, like, you know, like small compared to it, like ugly compared to it. Like I could never be that. And so it was always this like pain that I held around from a very young like age. And so as an adult, I knew, like, you know, I knew better. I understood what it was intellectually, you know, that it's a fantasy, that it's fabricated, that it doesn't, you know, devalue me. But there was still this like teenager inside of me emotionally, you know, so I saw that and I knew that that was some fodder for short film. And originally the film was through the POV of a porn star, but then eventually I just kind of it wasn't working. So
when you say it wasn't working, how did you workshop that? Was that in a like a writing workshop or was that just table reads? How did you figure out?
So at AFI, in our second year, we have a whole class dedicated to the thesis project. And through the entirety of the year, you're reading the scripts and you're getting feedback from your classmates and your teachers about like how the script is feeling, how it's working. You also have, you know, within your team of producer, DP, production designer, editor, you're assigned a mentor. And that mentor is the primary source of telling you if your script is working or not, if you're getting deep enough or not. So, and in those workshops and mentor sessions, like, we could just tell that, like, the predominant POV of the porn star wasn't quite relatable. There wasn't quite enough proper drama to it. Yeah, it was about her like losing a job that she wanted because they find out she used to be a porn star. But the stakes were weird and like it just wasn't clicking. So one frustrated, you know, afternoon, I think I just almost like, you know, filmmaker breakdown. I was like, what am I doing? I don't know. And just wrote down the most honest, emotionally honest version of what I thought the story should be. And that was essentially the, you know, housewife that goes to a porn convention and is a fish out of water was me emotionally.
Right, you know? Right, right. Yeah. That's great. I love that so much. And I think that there are things to take home from that, though, right? Like, there's so many nuggets there, right? Like, the emotional truth behind it, but also kind of on a more practical level, I think it's interesting to think about how people workshop, right, in an academic environment or elsewhere. Like, do you have a brain trust? Are you taking it? Like, who are you showing it to? How do you kind of figure that out, you know, outside of that environment, basically? Do you feel like since then you've been able to take those lessons and ideas and apply them to your own work in other ways?
Lessons and ideas that I kind of got from the mm-hmm. workshop project.
Workshopping, just film school in general. But I guess I'm asking, you know, outside of AFI, specifically to your shorts, I think is maybe the most germane. It's like, okay, like what helped you decide what to work on next? What helped you? How did you know when things clicked in and, you know, and when did you know when to go into production, basically?
Yeah. You know, I said that I made those first three films, right, at AFI first year. And those films, I saw twinkles of myself in them, but ultimately I find those films as, you know, fun, but failures. Like they weren't effective in communicating what, you know, really doing what I wanted it to do. And
on the terms of emotional truth, they're failures, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not an aesthetic thing or a technical thing at all. They all work and they're great fun movies, but like they're not as personal as you want them to be. That's great.
Exactly. And then I finally arrived at the thesis film and like went through the, you know, dark night of the soul to get to a thesis film that I think was working and personal to me. And that process was essential to teaching me how to now then navigate all the projects that came after it. It really was like the light bulb moment that made me go like, oh, this is my voice. This is how you utilize your personal narrative and yet like abstract it into a different kind of, you know, story that's not literally your story. So yeah, it was essential.
I think that what's so cool about that whole thing, and even just the way you pitched us this story and like how the idea came, you came up with it. Like I could see when you're in film school and someone's making like a sci-fi fantasy, someone's making like a time travel thing, someone's making like a war thing, you know, these kind of big set piece things, you know, or a period piece or something. And you're like, I want to tell this story. You know, I have this kind of interesting, like poignant take on like pornography in our culture. And what's the most interesting, like, kind of sharp way in? And it's, like, through the eyes of the porn star, right? Because that's, like, we, you know, that's what we all imagine, you know? But then you go, and I'm assuming with, like, the same budget that you have to do this porn star thing, you're grounding it into, like, something that's more you. And I'm guessing that, like, you see all your fellow, you know, filmmaking students are doing these, like, big, crazy genre set pieces, and you're doing it about a housewife that's going to have one conversation with her
husband.
They
still go to a convention, though, right?
Yeah, they go to a convention, and it's
that's
big.
That's a set piece. That's a, you know, yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, yeah. But it's a different color. Than,
right.
Than,
but finding the truth is more important than the spectacle, you know, of it all. It's kind of cool. It's cool how you came to it. And I think it's a problem I always have, too, in storytelling, is I'm like, who's the most interesting person in the scene? And what's the craziest vantage point? What's the most like unexpected, surprising, original thing I've never seen before? And sometimes I lose track of like, well, why am I making this, you know?
Yeah, I think that I still struggle with that. I mean, you know, the short that I made after AFI more independently, but before like 50 States, was a punk rock musical, and it definitely had a message that was very personal to me. But I do think that film, like, even though I feel like it's a successful film for me that I love, the aesthetic and my like desire to make a musical almost, I sometimes feel like overrode some of the emotional storytelling elements. So yeah, I think that that's a struggle that we all go through of like, oh, it's so fun to do this, but are you telling the story properly?
Yeah, well, and it's also hard because sometimes, you know, you've done such a great job of like articulating the specific, not just the log line, but why that film was important to you in such a concise and clear way that like everyone is jealous, right? Like, oh, dang, that's personal. That's so smart. That's filled with drama. And you've got it in one sentence. But I'm betting that even after that, you know, the morning after the Dark Night of the Soul, it wasn't that articulate yet, right? And so you're probably still following like, okay, you know, this porn thing is interesting and this point of view maybe needs to shift, and you're still refining things, right? And so in the same way that like being drawn to a punk rock aesthetic is important to listen to, right? Like it's not always so crystal clear what you're trying to say, and you just have to kind of like, you know, go where your heart takes you a little bit with what's drawing it, you know, and sometimes that's articulate and sometimes that's just like a feeling about an aesthetic. And so, you know, listeners at home, don't worry if you're not like, haha, my thesis, I've got it.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah. No, Kimi Kabuki was, you know, the thesis was definitely, you know, right before we shot, like what Dark Night of the Soul was me discovering that the right POV was the housewife. And I got through that. But then even after that, you know, between then and production, like a lot of my classmates who would like give me critical feedback about the script didn't really get it, or like had all these lofty other ideas of how it could be better or how it should be better. And so we went into production feeling like, is this good? We're getting mixed signals here. And but we still just like had to stick with our guns and make the best that we could. And there was a huge lesson making that thesis film was like, you're not going to please everybody. Like you really can't. And if 60% of the viewers get it and 40% don't, to me, that's a success. That's my ratio split. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially in film school, you're surrounded by people who are so smart and you admire, and you're seeing things that they're so good at that you're, you know, jealous of. You're like, oh man, I wish I could shoot like that. That's so awesome. You know, all of those different things. But you're conflicted with that feeling of like, I think I know what I want. I think I know what I'm trying to say. And I can't tell if this smart person is going to help me or distract me. And it's not like they're your boss. It's not like you have to, it's not a studio note. So they could be doing real damage to your vision, or you could be an obstinate jerk. You don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't know. Yeah. You don't know. So you're always navigating with like blinders on, and you're just trying to make the best like instinct decisions that you can the whole way.
Something that I've learned, especially through like commercial filmmaking, is, you know, it's a visual medium. And sometimes the way you write it or pitch it to someone just is really hard to understand. And the only way you can sell your idea is by showing it to someone, you know, whether it's an animatic or visual or storyboards or, I mean, I've been in so many meetings where we show storyboards and people are like, oh, this is the first time I understand what you're talking about, you know, or the first time I see the script. And a lot of times it's like, you know, I have to go shoot something on my iPhone and say like, this is how it is. And even after a shoot, like when an edit's not working, I'm like, can I play with the footage? Because I know it can work. I just, it's really hard for me to articulate exactly like what frame to cut on and which shot to be on. I kind of need to feel it because I know we captured it. I just need to find how it goes together. And it's, I think there is like a, with screenwriting, there's this idea that like, well, if it's in the script that, you know, if it works, it'll, you can tell from the script. And if it doesn't work, you can't tell from the script. But so many times that's not the case.
Yeah. So many things you realize after doing it over and over again is, you know, like execution contingent of like, is this going to work or not? Like something that works amazingly in a script might be totally terrible because of how you executed it, or it could be incredible. And so that's a part of the excitement, right? Is that like, you don't know if it's going to work or not. And it's also part of the terror.
Yeah. I do think, honestly, one of my skills, and I'm sure your skills as well, and the more you direct things, is the more instantly you can recognize that, yes, this is super funny on paper, but it will not work on screen, or it will take four shots to make this one joke that you say, like, so-and-so is implying this, but really meaning this. And you're like, well, how do I show that? That's going to take five beats. And like, how can we change that? Which I think a lot of producers and writers and other people in the mix don't think about the script to screen in the same way that a director does, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that is definitely a skill that I've developed now where, you know, if I'm working with a writer, it's like become my job to communicate like, this intention of yours is good, but will not be able to be executable in the way you see it when it actually becomes real life and real people and, you know, something actually in front of you.
Do you find, Yoko, that as you start working on more network shows, that problem gets a little less prominent? I guess I'm always hoping that like one of these days I'm gonna sit down with some writers who know exactly what the fuck they're doing, and we're gonna get past that one hump and onto even harder, bigger challenges.
Yeah, I mean, it depends really. The two shows that I've done have been such different experiences. One, like the script was completely locked the entire time, and it was, you know, and it was reliable in that way, and I could prep it and it wouldn't change. And the second experience I had was that it was actually very fluid. The writing was fluid, but they were like very collaborative about it. And so both scenarios,
the font on the script.
Yes, changing that to the bold. Yes. No, it was just like, there was more of a fluidity to the script in collaboration with the actors and like kind of what they saw the scene was going towards. And so, you know, there's no simple answer of like, once you start to get to these professional levels, like it changes because every writer is so different and every show is so different and the culture of it. So far, I've had great experiences only, you know, and so I've been very lucky.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm always just like, well, most showrunners have directed a lot. And so, you know, if they are the filter, then everything goes through them. Whereas like most other circumstances, you know, to no one's discredit, writers often haven't directed. And so like sometimes our experience is the thing that kind of helps them realize like, oh, this is the thing that we do have to rewrite this a tiny bit or whatever. Like you were saying, the intention is right, but it won't be executed the way you want it to be. But like with experience, the way oftentimes showrunners have, hopefully that gets filtered out a tiny bit more. Well, we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. I mean, the showrunners that also direct, absolutely. Yes. Know what they want.
It's their experience level too, right? Like I think you do more and more episodes. Like when you're in season five of your show, like things tighten up in a certain way.
Also in TV, people say what they think a lot, which makes it easier. Like
characters express their intentions, or you mean crew members are frank with one another?
No, characters talk a lot about what they're doing. And I mean, you know, we're talking about Law and Order earlier. It's like, that's like, and I know you're not directing Law and Order, but especially in those procedural things, that, like, the way they get from point A to point B, a lot of times the character saying like, hey, we looked that up, looks like this is the next place we need to go to, you know? And I mean, no, that's a bad example. And obviously there's like really good writing, but I find that like in TV, you err on the like side where things should be clear and things should track, and people should understand why a character does this and this and this. And it's not often going to rely on like one visual or one like performance quirk. Like there's like in TV, it's like you're reinforcing the clarity of the scene in like multiple ways.
Nothing spells that out more than if you watch a network show on a streaming service where there are no longer commercial breaks. Because you will feel the act break, and then in the next scene, very succinctly, the characters will just kind of quickly restate their circumstances and objectives, probably with a little joke or something, but just like in a, you know, a quarter of a page, probably just get it out, and then they're back on. But it's just like, remember, reader, you were thinking about buying a Toyota or some Snickers, but now we're back in the story. But like, you don't need that when you don't have ad breaks, basically.
Yeah,
it always makes me laugh.
It does definitely feel like TV for streamers and TV for anything with commercials has a different pacing to it, and you hope that you adapt depending on where you kind of know it's going to be shown primarily.
Yeah. I'm curious, Yoko, what was your first paid gig after AFI as a director?
My first paid gig after AFI was as a director was a Lifetime web series called Fall Into Me. I had just got...
Who produced that? Like, who was the line producer or like... I'm trying to think of...
Produced by Andrea Ajemian, Carrie LeGrand, Jamie Mayer, Saget Meyer, Schwartz, Guy Shalem, who I think I know that guy, Mark Coburg, David McKillop, Howard Owens, and Tina Pugliese?
Huh.
Pugliese?
None of those people. I've heard of that show for sure. In my Facebook feed, I feel like people have been like, check out our show.
But yes.
There
was, I think, like six of us directing different like storylines. So I'm sure you probably know somebody within all of that. But that was my first gig, which was cool. Like, you know, it was low budge, but, you know, graduating grad school and getting a gig pretty quickly was fun. It was like 50 pages.
And how did you get that?
So my thesis film at AFI, they do something called a showcase. When I went there, it was very kind of unfair in the sense that only three got to like showcase. Only three of the thesis films got to actually play at these things. But like everybody, each project had like a little like, you know, like a tabletop that had their project, and like they'd get like agents and managers to come and like mingle with you and talk. And I happened to talk to the manager of one of my writer friends who had a film in the showcase, I think. And so we got chatting and he liked my film. So I got a manager and he got me the Lifetime project.
He just like sent you the script and then you read it and you went and pitched on it?
I don't think it was even like that. I don't think there was even a script. That project was very loosey-goosey and like strange. The whole process, you know, it was the whole production office was out of one of the producers' house. And yeah, I think I just got like I was interning out of school at a commercial production company. And then like I got a call from a manager being like, hey, talk to this writer. Like they have this Lifetime thing and they have one more slot left. And it was very informal and quick. And like I went to the house that was their like production office, and they liked me and I seemed competent. So they hired me on to do two different storylines.
That's cool. And then did that lead to your next paid gig?
I don't think that led to my next paid gig, no. I think that was like a good, like, it was, we did like 50 pages in 5 days. So it showed me what I was capable of. And I was like, okay, I guess I could do TV. Someday, but that was like 2016 or something. And, I did not get like a narrative directing gig for a while after that. I actually worked as a freelancer for Super Deluxe, and that was kind of my paycheck for a while.
Oh, as a freelance producer or
like a director. Mm-hmm. But as a director, you're also doing, you know, camera and editing. So you're pretty much a creator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. Did you must have known Winnie Kemp over there then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's great. Yeah.
Yep.
I did three shows for Super Deluxe.
You did? Oh, which ones?
I did. The first one was called, I mean, none of them were like super popular.
There's two different generations of Super Deluxe.
Oh, yeah. I might have been Generation One.
Yeah.
Were you doing the more narrative stuff before, like, the more content-y things came up?
Yeah. Like, when Derek and Simon, do you know Derek Waters and Simon?
Yeah, I know Derek.
They had a show on there called Derek and Simon, and then there was Maria Bamford had a show on there. It was kind of, I think it was Super Deluxe 1.0. Yeah, so mine, I did three narrative shows. One was called I Hate My Roommates, this girl that murders her roommates for entertainment. Then I did one that was called Bad Ad, which was like about these advertising executives that it was like a hybrid show. It was like hidden camera kind of, and we would show people like offensive ads and see how long they would stay at these focus groups before they would like leave.
That's amazing. Yes, that's the OG Super Deluxe. That's fun.
But yeah, so Super Deluxe 2.0 is totally different, I guess.
Yes, I was in 2.0 right after I graduated. Like, they were just like trying to nap up all the, you know, earlier emerging filmmakers to like make stuff for them. So yeah, I definitely knew Winnie. She was doing more of, I had developed a script with her, I think, but then like the entirety of Super Deluxe was like, yeah, we're not gonna really do scripted stuff anymore. And just really lean into the YouTube stuff.
Cool. Well, so I see like on your website that you did the Ryan Murphy, you were a Ryan Murphy Half Foundation Fellow, Warner Brothers Directing Workshop, Women in Film, Sundance Institute, like Fox Global Directing Initiative. Did all that stuff introduce you to the right people to get TV work?
Yeah, I think my first program, the Fox Diversity Program, was 2017, I believe. And so, you know, it was like 2 years between graduating school and even getting into my first diversity program. I had been, you know, applying to them for a really long time before I even got in. And yeah, that first one is so funny. But yeah, once you get into one of the like TV directing diversity programs, that kind of does open the door for you to be able to get into the next one and the next one. And so that eventually definitely did lead to probably where I am today. But at that time, you know, it doesn't lead to anything directly. You know, I didn't get hired for anything off of the Fox directing program, but it, you know, trickled down eventually to lead to somewhere.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that's actually a pretty common story that we've heard, is that there's a lot of people that are like, yeah, I did all of them. And then on my very last one, I was about to give up and I finally got my first episode of something. Though I think that they're maybe getting a little bit more proactive now about like saying, hey, we're going to give you an episode of a show, basically. Like some of them, I feel like maybe NBC has one. I don't want to speak out of turn because I'm not super familiar, but I think they're trying to make that a little bit more of a direct correlation.
Yes. There's two programs that usually guarantee that if you get into this program, you will be directing one of our shows, and that is NBC and Warner Brothers. I did the Warner Brothers last during COVID. I did the COVID Warner Brothers workshop, which was all online. And they did a fabulous job of actually still making it a very educational program. They could not guarantee us episodes during the COVID year, so that's unfortunate. But they have a reputation of being one of the best because they usually do that.
And how do you get in? Like, what do they judge you on?
It's an open application. They judge you on your work sample. You have to submit a narrative film. Every program has different qualifications, but I think Warner Brothers specifically is like, you need to submit a film that played in one of these festivals. They have an actual list that has to be like ticked off. And you then submit like also, of course, like an essay. Again, depending on the program, it could be anything like, you know, what is your unique perspective and your background? You know, how will that contribute to TV directing? Or like, why do you want to direct for TV specifically? So stuff like that.
And having directed Good Trouble and a Quibi show didn't disqualify you from acceptance?
So no, I did the 2020 Warner Brothers workshop 2 months before, honestly, a month before I got the call for Good Trouble. So Quibi did not disqualify me because it was not a TV show. But Warner Brothers happened right before I got Good Trouble.
Cool. So what's next? Are you now getting like TV offers left and right?
I have actually a lot of attachments for features that I'm hoping will actually pop and actually get going. And yeah, I've continued to take a lot of meetings for TV. Now that my episode's out, my reps are definitely hustling that to people and trying to get my next thing. So I have a lot of meetings. But yeah, I'm still very passionate about telling stories that I'm, you know, that I initiate and telling stories in feature format. So definitely hustling TV episodics. But yeah, I have a lot of different things going on.
And for the features, is that stuff that you wrote or things that you like your reps found for you? Or how do you attach yourself to a feature?
I have several features I'm attached to, and yeah, I think it's predominantly my reps have kind of like matched me with writers who've had scripts, and they kind of package me that way with them, and we develop the script together a little bit more further from where they did it, and you know, I make like a lookbook, and then they kind of go out to producers and stuff. I have a few of those, but I also have an attachment to one that already had a producer, and they were looking for a director, and that came through my reps. But I've also, you know, written several on my own and with co-writers that were trying to get made through that route. So every scenario,
all the ways, yeah,
yes, all of them,
every hustle you can think of, for sure. Yeah.
I guess my kind of last question about that stuff is like, so now that you've done Good Trouble, you've done The Bold Type, you've done your shorts, and you do all these docs, and on your website, I mean, you just have everything. You have like Vimeo staff pick docs and music videos. And you
I
even
believe
have
you,
like,
you refer to yourself as genre fluid, which I love. That's
I do.
So good.
Yes. I to this day, I think I actually coined it because I haven't heard other people use it yet. So,
it's so good.
I think,
it's so good. It's like such a good...
Mine.
Because I think that sometimes, you know, people want to be like, well, yeah, I do a lot of different things. And Holly wants to be like, no, no, put yourself in a box. But like that phrase in particular, I think people get it. It like it feels like young and new and now. You know what I mean? It's cool. It's good. It's really
well,
good.
What is your favorite thing? Like what genre do you want to work in? Or like, are you most excited about today?
Yeah. So I say I'm genre fluid because I do love, you know, narrative expression and all kinds of mediums and genres. But, you know, like my origin, like that I love is like kind of the dramedy space with, you know, about porn stars and, you know, regular people having dramas in their lives. But now at this point in my career, I love putting those, you know, human dramas that I care a lot about and putting that in like a horror space or like an elevated space, right? So 50 States of Fright really came out of nowhere for me. Like I wasn't expecting to do horror. I wasn't seeking horror specifically, but I always knew I wanted to tell stories that were, you know, more edgier and had like a level of elevation to the narrative. And when that came to me and I did it, I kind of fell in love with the genre. And now pretty much most things that I'm attached to is in the horror space. But it's always going to have like the heart that I care about, which is again, like,
right. But it's going to be pulled out of somebody's chest.
Yes, exactly. Hey, literally.
There you go. Well, and you know, also I think that's a really good space to be in, especially for a first feature, right? Like I feel like there's a lot of opportunity there. So it's nice to, on a careerist level, to think about it that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of examples of people who made a name in horror as a jumping, you know, as a way to start off. And yeah, and now I sincerely just enjoy it. Like being able to like make the special effects of like this giant ball and like having all the goop and like having all the action sequences and choreography. Like I just love the craft of all that too. So I really
yeah,
like
I think Jeremy Saulnier calls it the arts and crafts of filmmaking. And I've always really loved that. Like, yeah, it's like neat to like make something out of plaster that looks like a dead body or whatever, you know.
It's just fun. Like that's the that's movie magic, right? And that's kind of how, what we all fell in love with it in the first place. And, so yeah, like there's a lot of topics like, you know, very relevant topic like social justice things that I love that's discussed in shows like Good Trouble and The Bold Type. And I love to put that into more like fantastical worlds and elevate it. And that's
Couldn't
what I want to do.
One of them be a vampire, though?
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Yeah, yeah. It's always possible.
Yoko, that's awesome. If people want to like find out what you're doing next, is like do you post it on your website or what's the best way for people to like kind of keep track of what you're doing?
Yeah, I am pretty active on Instagram. My name is For Yoko, F-O-U-R-Y-O-K-O, as a reference to the greatest beverage that's ever been created in human
not
history.
Bad. Not bad.
Thank you. And I actually recently have been dabbling in the TikTok world, where I specifically try to make videos where I like give advice to people who want to be filmmakers.
Oh,
so
awesome. Yeah, well, definitely shout that out.
At Director Yoko. So you can find me there.
Cool. Are people receptive to it?
Yeah. You know, I was just like, when I was quarantining in Montreal for 2 weeks and nothing to do, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to give it a shot. And my niche can be, you know, a filmmaker. And so I was kind of casually making it over a while. But like the last few days, I made one that kind of like, you know, so I had gone back to work at Kazunori like last January 2020 because I was just like, even I had just done the Quibi show, but I still wasn't quite making ends meet. So I went back to the service industry.
You need money. Yeah.
I need money. And so, you know, I kind of told the story of, like, you know, in a TikTok where I was at a sushi restaurant at the beginning of the year. And by the end of the year, I was directing television. And, you know, told that little thing in a 60-second thing. And that kind of blew up. And I'm surprising, like, we got to have a lot of followers now. So
awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well,
cool. What's a lot of followers on TikTok?
I mean, in TikTok world, it's not a lot. It's a lot for me. It's like over a week, I got like 13,000 followers. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's not bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
TikTok world, that's pretty small.
Sure. People get, yeah, like, you're not an influencer. No brands are hitting you up just yet, for sure. But yeah, that's
someone
still
actually offered me some free, like, hair stuff because they like my hair.
Oh,
so,
okay. Well, I stand corrected.
It.
There you go. I hope that when they revise Four Loko, when they bring it back, I hope you get hit up as well. Have you ever had one? I feel
Four
Loko, really? Yeah, I've never tried one. I think they were gone by the time I was aware of them.
I was in college at the height of Four Loko, so I was the target audience.
Yeah.
I feel like we should steal your video title for this episode title, which is your video that blew up on TikTok. Success is not linear.
Very true. That is the title.
That's you. You own that.
I do.
Non-linearity.
There you go.
Yes. Well,
linear fluid career.
Yeah. All mishy-mashy and wishy-washy, something like that.
Well, Yoko, we can't wait to learn more about all of your insight on TikTok. But before you get back to TikToking, do you have a second to hang out and endorse with us?
I would love to endorse with you.
Unpaid endorsements.
My unpaid endorsement is the comedian Fortune Feimster has a new Netflix special, Sweet and Salty. It's her new stand-up special. And I've always loved Fortune Feimster. I feel like she kind of came out of the gate with just, like, such a clear voice and, like, point of view and comedic style that always clicked for me. I've always loved it. But this special, I feel like she's just at the height of her powers. Like, it's so funny. It's so relatable. It's still quite, like, broad too. You know what I mean? I feel like everybody can laugh at this special, but it's still literally only Fortune Feimster can do that material. So I thought it's nice to check out a stand-up special every once in a while. And it's on Netflix. They're doing great work. Nate Bargatze had a great special as well. So stand-up is back, maybe thanks to Netflix. I don't know. I miss it. So it was really great. So Fortune Feimster, Sweet and Salty.
What I love about, like, those stand-up specials is you know, obviously you want to watch them, but you can also just kind of have them playing while you're working on something else.
Oftentimes,
you know, washing the dishes or doing things.
Netflix, I think they used to definitely do this. I don't know if they still do, but they would put them out as records as well that you could just stream on Spotify.
Oh.
Yeah.
Netflix did that?
Yeah. Yeah. Before I started working at Comedy Central, I had a very extensive, like, CD collection of, like, specials. I had record stores would be going out of business, and so I'd be like, all right, Virgin Megastore, where's your comedy section? And just swoop all of them up. So, like, I have a strong affinity for specials in particular. That's kind of how I got my job at Comedy Central, was just having that back catalog. So
you're the guy that at the party,
yeah,
take the record out.
I'd be like,
instead of it being like Miles,
sure,
Davis, it's like
you're that guy,
Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh, cool. Dr. Demento record. I do have, like, first edition, like, John Mulaney records before he was famous, for sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's a fan.
Yoko, what you got?
Okay, so my unpaid endorsement is this, like, very small, like, micro grant, like, resource that's called Squid Tropica. They're created by two artists. One's a muralist called Squid Liquor. Their name is Lauren. And a pop musician named Polar Tropica. And they give, like, support LGBTQ and, like, BIPOC artists by giving them micro grants to support their art. And they're predominantly, like, an Instagram, you know, account, but, you know, people can submit and people can donate money to support artists. And if you're, like, struggling artist who just needs a little bit of, like, cash flow to help out, they can receive applications and then, like, give those out. So
yeah, I love that. What constitutes a micro grant? Like, how much cash are we talking about here? Is it like $50? Is it $2,000? Like,
I think it's like a couple hundred. Like, I think 200 is like the world, or 100 is the world. I think that's what you call a micro grant.
That's cool. Did you guys hear in San Francisco they are like choosing like 30 or 80 or 100 artists like in the city and giving them either $1,000 or $2,000 a month to just do their art. It's kind of like a pandemic grant, but they're like, you know, during COVID, we're worried that people are going to be stressed, you know, and not making as much art. So we want to support those artists.
Yeah, I think one, you know, silver lining of COVID has been like these artist supporting programs. Like, again, Squid Tropica was kind of born out of trying to help LGBTQ BIPOC artists who are struggling right now. But I also, I was a recipient of a Vimeo small business like grant that was at the very beginning of the pandemic. They gave me and a business money for me to make a documentary about them.
That's awesome. Yeah. Where can, is that available? Can viewers check that out?
Yes.
Or listeners check that out?
I made a documentary with the Vimeo grant about a tattoo artist, a tattoo shop in Highland Park that, of course, you know, with the COVID restrictions was not able to work. And so I made a documentary called Permanent Healing, and that's on Vimeo.
Awesome.
Is that part of Stories in Place?
Yes, Stories in Place. That was their series. Yeah. And I will always give an unpaid endorsement to Vimeo. I think, you know, they've always been around for us.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Or like 99 yeah. bucks a year, actually.
Yeah. That kind of around. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right?
Awesome. Did you have another endorsement?
I do. These are like, go you know, it. Again, you don't okay. have to use yeah. all of these,
no,
but.
No, that's perfect. That's great.
I was just like looking around of like, you know, I think what's important, especially right now for all of us artists, is like find small joys in our life. And I was like, what has brought me small joys in my life? And that is Mickey Hargerty's in Los Angeles is my favorite plant store where I got all my beautiful plants. And I'm obsessed with plants and I have many, many in my apartment. And yeah, they get a neon pothos from Mickey Hargerty's in Hollywood. And I think you'll be very happy.
Wait, a neon pothos? That's a type of plant?
Neon pothos is my favorite plant. It's the one hanging right there. People can't see, but you can. It's a bright green plant that's very hard to kill. So I recommend that plant to everybody.
Awesome.
Well, cool. I'm going to endorse something I haven't watched yet. Can I do that? On occasion, I endorse things that I'm about to try.
You have to circle back if you hate it, though.
I will. And I did that with the bug assault gun, a salt shooter to get rid of flies that destroyed my house and my marriage. So I have not watched this yet, but I'm going to watch it maybe tonight. Have you guys heard of this documentary about Jackie Chan called My Stunts? So I heard about it from the VFX or Stunt People React. It's like on the Corridor Digital channel on YouTube, Corridor 2 or whatever their like behind the scenes channel is. They have stunt people react to stunt scenes in movies. And they were saying that this documentary, Jackie Chan, My Stunts, is like a must watch for everyone. And you can watch the whole movie for free on YouTube. And he basically like goes into a scene and explains how he comes up with like what the stunts are in a scene. And it tells people like anyone can do it if they like practice enough and stuff. So I'm very excited to watch it because that stunt choreography is like, we watch it and it's like, looks like magic to us, but it's so fun to think that Jackie Chan is going to like deconstruct it and take us through his process, like a masterclass.
That sounds
Jackie Channing.
Amazing. I'm endorsing that too. I'm going to watch that tonight. That sounds incredible.
Look at Matt's face. He's like, this whole segment is falling.
No, I love it.
Endorsing
so
things they don't even
I
know.
Love it. Here, so I have seen some of it. And I will say that also on top of what you just described, Oren, it's very clearly like a solid like 90s DVD, direct to DVD sort of, or rather probably actually like was made and then imported, and so it's got like a lot of like cheesy ass graphics and like really like synthy music and stuff, like the most 90s Jackie Chan you can imagine, which is like a version of Jackie that I love very dearly. So you get that extra layer of like cheese on top of a lot of great content, so get ready. It's almost like, you know, like a Snapchat filter level of like of intro sequencing. Yeah. It's like pretty crazy. So yeah.
I'm even more excited.
That's a triple endorsement, I think, for Jackie Chan, My Stunts. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe Yoko and my endorsement are like one or half each.
Co-endorsement.
So like two endorsements.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you at home or on your commute to your living room or wherever you work from nowadays, Have any thoughts about what we talked about? Want to share your endorsements or your questions for Yoko? We can pass them on to her. You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on all social media at justshootitpod. I'm on Instagram at okaplan and on Twitter at smitypyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our social media maestro is Derek Aiello, and additional consulting producing from Ali Kornfeld. Check us out at justshootitpod.com. Oh, and the music you're listening to is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.